Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In the wake of the recent series of police shootings against unarmed black victims around the country and the ongoing debate on the rightful use of deadly force by police officers, a new book revisits one of the most egregious police shootings where now, even 10 years after the incident, the victims' families' work to find justice remains in doubt. In the days after Hurricane Katrina, civil order certainly broke down in New Orleans and the police who remained felt under siege. But on the morning of September 4th, 6 days after the storm made landfall, a group of stressed officers were called to the Danziger Bridge based on a report of shots fired. There they encountered members of two families, the Bartholomew family and the Madisons, who were crossing the bridge to find refuge from their flooded area where they survived the storm. All were unarmed, but police opened fire, killing two and grievously wounding four. Immediately, a cover-up took place, which unraveled nearly 2 years later, thanks to the dogged efforts of the family, and eventually the four shooting officers and a supervisor were sentenced. But in a bizarre turn, the trial judge overturned the convictions and ordered a new trial 2 years later. And just last month, the U.S. Court of Appeals upheld that ruling. My guest today has written about this incident and the aftermath. Shots on the Bridge, Police Violence and Cover-Up in the Wake of Katrina. It's published by Beacon Press. Ronnie Green is an investigative reporter for the Associated Press and teaches at Johns Hopkins University. Prior to joining AP, he edited the 2014 Pulitzer Prize-winning investigation for the Center of Public Integrity on the coal industry's efforts to beat back coal miners' claims of black lung disease. And prior to that, he was an investigative journalist for the Miami Herald. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Ronnie Green, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Before Ferguson, Missouri, before Baltimore and the other police shootings that have made the news, there was a story of what happened on the Danziger Bridge in New Orleans a few days after Hurricane Katrina, September 4th, 2005. What exactly happened on the Danziger Bridge, and why did it interest you as an investigative journalist here now 10 years later?
Sure. There was a tragic confluence of events that morning. Of course, this was, as you noted, 6 days after Katrina, when the entire city was in disarray. Residents who were still behind were just trying to survive. The police officers, in many ways, were as well. And then this morning, it was actually a nice morning. The sun was out. There was a convergence of residents and police officers on a very small bridge in New Orleans called the Danziger Bridge. Basically, there were two families, Rich, who were just trying to survive. One of the families was hoping to walk over the bridge to buy some cleaning and medical supplies at a store that had just opened up. In another one of the families that morning had been living at their, these two brothers have been living at their brother's dental office. They were going to walk over the bridge, try to get back to the family home and ride on bikes and just pedal as far away from the misery as they could. So they were just trying to survive when, at that moment, police were responding to a distress call and raced to the bridge. And I should say this was, you know, obviously not a normal time for anyone. Police weren't driving around in police vehicles. They were driving around in any vehicle they could commandeer. And this morning, the officers involved were driving a budget rental truck. So they stormed to the bridge at the site of this distress call where they thought maybe an officer was under fire. And they raced to the bridge not only with their own police-issued weapons, but with some of their own weapons. The driver of the truck had an AK-47, his own AK-47, that he had tucked between the front seats every time he drove out. And so this morning they raced to the bridge, and they saw groups of people on the bridge, and without asking questions, they started firing. The police started firing, assuming that these residents were somehow involved in this distress call. And it was such a really crazy time that the driver of the truck, actually before he came to a stop, he leaned out the window and started firing with a handgun with one hand while steering with the other. Of course, these two families who were just trying to get by that morning had no idea what was going on, no idea why people were shooting at them. By the time the shooting was done, two residents were killed. A 40-year-old man with the mental development of a 6-year-old named Ronald Madison was killed on one end of the bridge. And a 17-year-old, James Brissett Jr., who really, you know, was on the cusp of life, had dreams of his life ahead of him, he was killed on the other side of the bridge. And four residents were seriously injured. A mother lost her arm. And before the victims were even taken to the hospital, the surviving gunshot wound victims, the police concocted a cover-up. So the second part of your question is, I had first knew about this case in August of 2011 when I just happened to read a story, a wire service story by the AP, about the conviction in federal court of some of the officers. And that story had some details, some of which I just described to you about what happened. And the story stopped me in my tracks. And I instantly wanted to know who were the residents, who were the officers on the bridge, how literally did they get there that day, why were they still in town, and in a way suspend time and learn how and why these residents and officers converged, and then try to figure out the story. And the more I looked into it, you know, the more painful and I thought and important the story was to tell.
Tell us a little bit more about the Bartholomew and Madison families. Why were they still in New Orleans? And in fact, the story of why they were, it was coincidence. In the case of the Bartholomew family, they just didn't have enough transportation to get everybody away.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, as I had mentioned, when I first read that first story and stopped in my tracks and felt that this was a story that I really had to tell, I really wanted to know why were the residents there. And the answers were so human and just really pointed. Let me start with the Madisons. The Madison family is this really proud, really wonderful New Orleans family. The parents gave birth to 10 kids. And a lot of the kids grew into adults who did great things in their lives. So the family was planning to leave. The family was planning to head out of New Orleans. But the younger brother, Ronald Madison, was a 40-year-old with the mental development of a 6-year-old. He would not leave the family dogs. He was literally crying. He was fearful he would leave the family dogs. Where the family planned to go, they couldn't take the pets. And so he just pleaded and pleaded. He wanted to stay behind. So the decision was made that Ronald would stay behind with his older brother, Lance. Lance Madison, really a stoic figure. He had been, at one point, an NFL football player who had now worked at FedEx for 25 years. So Lance would stay back with Ronald, and they would stay in Lance's condos. So that's why the Madison brothers were there. As far as the Bartholomew family, Susan Bartholomew, the mother, whose arm was later shot off on the bridge, she gathered her family together in her second-floor apartment. I think there were 10 or 11 family members there as the storm was coming. And she realized they had just one van, but 10 or 11 people needing a way out. And there was just no way that she felt like everyone could leave. So she made a choice, a very human choice. If we all can't go, we're all going to stay. So both families stayed behind, as I mentioned, really for human reasons. And each family, the Madisons and the Bartholomews, were literally chased to their roofs after the flooding and pleaded for a helicopter rescue, and the rescue never came. So they went through torturous days and nights where this morning they were just trying to get out, just trying to get to the store in one case and just trying to get to the family home in the other.
And the Danziger Bridge is very close to the I-10 bridge over the Industrial Canal. And this sort of leads to some of the mix-ups that led to the shooting, correct? Somewhat.
It was truly, yeah. It was truly chaotic and crazy. And a couple of days before this, a New Orleans police officer responding to looting at a store, later on was patting down some people walking through town. He was shot in the head. He survived, but that really put police, who were already beyond high alert, put them way beyond edge. You know, I think in some cases, I've talked to a lot of officers, there can be an us versus them mentality between the department and maybe some communities. In this case, after that shooting, it was clearly us versus them. So what happened was some other officers descending the I-10 saw a man waving his arm saying, "Hey, someone's shooting at us." And apparently earlier that morning, there were a couple of guys who had guns and may have been firing. So the call went in to, over the police radio, the communication system was crazy, chaotic, scratchy. The call went in 108, which means officer under fire. So when the police officers who responded to Danziger, they were operating from a banquet hall 3 miles away. That was their headquarters. When they heard this 108 call that morning, they assumed that, I think, officers were under fire, and they raced to the bridge in this budget rental truck, I think filled with fear that they were going to be heading into a shootout. They arrive at the bridge, and these two families who had nothing to do with anything with shooting, each member was unarmed, just trying to survive, were there. So that's where these events unfolded. And the police didn't ask questions, didn't stop. They just started shooting.
One of the first officers, and one of the officers who was later convicted, I believe it was Anthony Villavasso, when he originally gets on the scene, he goes, "Where are the shooters? These people are not shooters." And at that moment, something comes over the radio, apparently, that says, "That's them." Has that been verified, or was that just one account?
The driver of the truck, is actually, his name is Michael Hunter. He's the one who started firing warning shots out the window before we even came to a stop. As he's pulling up close to the bridge, he sees people, but he doesn't really right away see any weapons and is wondering, you know, where are they? Where are these suspects? When at that point in time, the chaotic moments during this, you know, this time where officers were connecting to handheld radios, one of the officers had called in, that's them. She had seen somebody else. So in the confusion and the chaos, I guess the officers assumed these may have been the people they were looking at. And so it was so chaotic that officers in front of this truck started firing while there were like 9 officers in the cargo area of the truck in the back. So they hear the firing, and they probably assume there is a gunfight. So one thing leads to the next. And by the time the gunfire stopped, 2 were dead, 4 were seriously injured, life-threatening injuries. So Susan lost her arm. And the other 2 members of the family were not shot, but it's only because officers missed, and they launched a cover-up instantly.
How many shots were fired? Does anybody ever know how many shots were actually?
I'm not sure if we ever have. For the families, it seemed like forever, as one of the family members said. It seems like the shots went on forever. It was so loud, so cacophonous, that the driver of the truck, Michael Hunter, whose bullets apparently did not strike any of the victims, he had to wave his arms. He had spent a little bit of time in the Marines. He waved his arms to signal stop, cease fire.
Hmm. In the immediate aftermath of the shooting, how did the cover-up take shape?
It really started right away. So after the gunfire stopped, you know, scores of other officers and I think even state police were there. And some other officers, there was one really interesting perspective. There was another group of officers, New Orleans officers, who were not involved in the shooting but heard some of the static over the radio. They were actually getting around that day in a limousine that they had commandeered. One of the officers came out of the truck and saw the victims but didn't see any guns. And it just didn't add up. He didn't see any bullet holes in the police budget truck, and he didn't understand what was going on. He walked from one end of the bridge to the other, and he could not believe what he was seeing, and that is no guns by the victims. And he just was troubled by this, and I think it was clear to some people right away that something was wrong with the shooting. But for some of the officers involved and some of the supervisors who came, they immediately discussed the cover-up. One of the supervisors who arrived shortly after the shooting whispered to another that he had a gun, he could plant a gun. And so the officers, really, they started the cover-up right away, right on that bridge. And over the coming days and weeks and months, what they did, what the department did, was they planted a gun. They said Lance Madison, the protector of Ronald, who lost his brother in this horrible moment, they said Lance Madison was armed, was firing first. It was fiction. They said Jose Holmes, who was a nephew of Susan Bartholomew, who was literally within a breath of his life, they said Jose was firing as well. They created a fiction that was so brazen that they invented witnesses. One day, one of the supervisors involved yelled out, "Give me a name." And one of the officers who was working on the police reports justifying the shooting just blurted out, "Lakeisha." So in the police report, Lakeisha Smith was now listed as one of the witnesses who said that the victims were firing first, and it was complete fiction.
Now, this fiction held for some time, didn't it?
Oh, it did. It did hold for some time. And really, one of the things that was truly striking to me in researching this was that it took the families. It took the families saying, there's no way this happened the way the police said it. It took them to unearth the truth. So, you know, police put out a press release portraying their series of events that these victims, the families were armed, which they weren't. None of the members had any guns. But a year later, the family started filing a series of lawsuits that changed the narrative. It started to change the narrative. It said we were 2 groups of families. J.J. Brissett was good friends with Jose Holmes, so he was with the Bartholomew family. 2 good families who were just trying to survive were unarmed, and they were attacked by these officers, and then a cover-up started. And the lawsuits also talked about the police culture, the supervision, how lacking the supervision was from the mayor on down that could allow this type of system to happen. So really it was the families who shone a light on the truth more than anyone else at the beginning of this.
I believe it was Lance Madison was detained and was going to be charged, right?
Lance Madison was charged. Lance Madison spent, I believe, 25 days in jail. He was handcuffed and he was treated like a criminal. And when he was being held in a temporary jail upstate of New Orleans towards Baton Rouge, he initially stood with his back to the wall because he was afraid someone would kill him before he could tell the truth. And the family pressed and pressed and pressed and said, there's just no way this happened. Lance was released on bond after 25 days in jail because there was a magistrate judge who heard him speak and just could not believe that he was armed. And he set the bond to a measure to which the family could at least get him out. Imagine for Lance Madison, you know, he was Ronald's protector. He made this tragic, poignant decision to try to find help for his brother, and his brother was shot down and killed. He then is charged and accused of firing at officers. That is an outrage that, you know, it's just difficult to fathom or to explain.
My guest today is Ronnie Green, investigative reporter for the Associated Press. He teaches at Johns Hopkins University. His book is titled Shots on the Bridge, Police Violence and Cover-Up in the Wake of Katrina, published by Beacon Press. And this story remains in the news to this day, at least about a month ago. And the federal appeals court finally has overturned the convictions of the police officers who were not convicted in state court but in federal court. And this gets into this story. Finally, after this, well, this cover-up went on for about a year, almost 2 years, really, until things start to unravel. And, of course, we have to remember Katrina was a time of craziness. You mentioned that police officer that was shot in the head. You also had incidents on the Gretna Bridge where law enforcement authorities turned away a whole bunch of people trying to cross the bridge just to get out of New Orleans. There was all sorts of craziness during this time. What did the families do to start breaking down this cover-up?
Well, they started asking questions, which honestly they've not stopped asking. Started asking a lot of questions, looking at the evidence. You know, they hired attorneys who were well-versed in these issues. Some of their attorneys have dealt with police civil rights abuses in New Orleans over many, many years, and they dug and they asked questions, and they kept presenting their evidence to the local DA and said, look, there's a whole other side of this story. So several months after the family's lawsuits were filed, those lawsuits were filed in the summer of 2006, a year after the incident, the shootings on the bridge. Then in, I believe it was December of 2006, the local DA initially brought charges against the officers involved in the shootings. But that case fell apart in the state court. And one of the things that remained striking for me, I went back to the families really pushing for the truth was vital in this. Even while the case was pending in the local DA's office in New Orleans, the families, in particular the Madison family, they didn't sit idly by. They didn't trust the local system to right this really horrific wrong. And so even while the case was pending, they and their friends and supporters were urging the Federal Department of Justice, the Civil Rights Division, to get involved. They were asking for help even while the case was pending. And ultimately, they were proven correct. The state case was dismissed. The judge felt that there were technical errors by the DA. State waste case was dismissed in 2008. Ultimately, the DOJ got involved in the Civil Rights Division and really dug, I think, far deeper than anyone else had and started, ultimately, they pierced that police wall of silence. And they convinced a couple of the shooters and a couple of supervisors to cooperate and to tell the full truth of what happened.
Now, one of the things I found interesting about the book is it is somewhat balanced. You really get a sense of where the officers were coming from in the days leading up to this incident and their own feelings. Now, did you actually speak with the officers, or did those come from depositions and court testimony?
It came from a lot of sources. When I was initially researching this book, my first trip for this book down to New Orleans was in April of 2012. This was the sentencing for five officers who went to trial. They were convicted of nearly every count and received sentences up to 65 years. And before the sentencing hearing, the victim spoke, Lance Madison spoke, and addressed each officer by name and called them out for their crimes and what they had done to his family. None of the officers spoke, but a number of their colleagues did. And the number of the colleagues who served during Katrina spoke. And none of them, you know, sort of excused the harm to the victims. So many of those officers said, it could have been me. In other words, this time was so frenzied and chaotic and unprecedented that, you know, when you hear a call that you think officers are under fire, you're going to respond this way. So I thought in researching this book, it was really important to understand life, you know, after Katrina. I had lived through hurricanes before, but nothing like Katrina, to understand what the citizens and what the officers were going through. And I tried to present that in the book. Now, I also felt it was vital to present what happened on that bridge and to say it as clearly as possible, because you know, the officers, you can't shoot first. The shooting did horrible harm to these families, and the cover-up was significant. But leading up to it, I thought it was important to really describe the culture that these officers were living through. You know, a lot of them sent their families off to higher ground and reported for duty. And I think there were, you know, clearly some officers who were staying behind for the right reasons to help out their community.
Yeah. Now, after the conviction in federal court, you would think this case was decided. But for the most bizarre reason ever, there was an appeal made. And it had to do with other prosecutors in the federal district attorney's office that had been making, I assume, what were anonymous comments to websites that were reporting on this case.
Well, that's right. A really quick note, and I'll get to that. And that is, you're right. The trial judge who oversaw the trial in New Orleans, and the trial played out in 2011. In 2013, he vacated the jury verdict and essentially ordered a new trial. And what's striking for me is two things. One is he ordered a trial for reasons that have nothing to do with what happened that morning. And 10 years later, these residents were all unarmed, were all completely innocent. They still do not have justice, which I think is one of the most striking elements of this. And so the judge overturned the jury verdict in large measure because, as you noted, anonymous comments. There were a couple of prosecutors, in particular one who was not involved in this case, who, whenever there were stories about police wrongdoing in New Orleans, would go online at the Times-Picayune, and at the bottom of stories where there's comments, he would anonymously post a lot of criticisms of the police department, of the officers, in this case and in many others, not just this case. And so the defense attorneys for the officers, when they filed appeals, their basis of their appeal was, hey, these comments, they argued, were part of a larger DOJ conspiracy to sort of convict the officers before they got even had their day in court. They felt it was part of a larger plan to cast aspersions on the department and hurt their chances of having a fair trial. It really seemed like a long-shot appeal, and I think the judge even initially said that. But ultimately, he vacated the jury verdict in large measure because of those types of issues, which I think it's been shocking to many people who follow this case. Now, and also really troubling for the families who have the prospect of having to go through this trial again.
Now, after that appeal was granted and a new trial ordered, the federal government appealed to appeals courts. This has been going on for 2 years. And in fact, your book, it comes out in August, right around the 10th anniversary of Katrina. What happens also in August of 2015?
Yeah, that's right. That was, I think, actually the day the book came out, there was an appeals court ruling by a 2-1 vote that upheld the lower court ruling in setting the stage for a potential new trial. The Department of Justice has another possible avenue or two to try to appeal that. But for me, again, the most striking thing is here we are more than 10 years later in a case where the victims truly were that, victims. There still is not a resolution in this case. That is such a telling, I think, fact.
My guest today is Ronnie Green, investigative reporter with Associated Press. He teaches at Johns Hopkins University and is the author of Shots on the Bridge, Police Violence and Cover-Up in the Wake of Katrina. And it's the book is published by Beacon Press, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. At the end of your book, you write, this is perhaps, it's not the first, it's not the last, but it's one of the most egregious police shootings in what has finally come to public attention is this issue between what some people would call blue-on-black crime and violence and police shootings. What does this say? What does this particular case infer about what we're now grappling with as a society?
That's a great question. One of the things that really I was thinking about is, as I was researching this book, of course, all these other cases, North Charleston case with Walter Scott, Freddie Gray in Baltimore, Staten Island with Eric Garner, all those cases had happened and really crystallized national attention and informed what I think is almost like a new civil rights movement. But you rarely saw this case mentioned in those cases. And I thought a couple of things. One is, when you look at the level of trauma on that bridge and also the scope of the cover-up, it's hard to think of a civil rights abuse that is more egregious than this one, than what happened on the small bridge in New Orleans 10 years ago. I think there are some important lessons. One is, it truly took the families to shine a light on the truth here. It really took them to push and push and push to bring some of the truth to this case. Were it not for those families, who knows if that would have ever come out. Another thing I gave a great deal of thought to in researching this, looking at these other cases, is the importance of the leadership from the mayor on down. At this time during Katrina, you know, there was a mayor who had never held public office before. He was a business person, Ray Nagin, who had never held public office before. And I think there was a feeling in the department that the department could operate as it saw fit. Years earlier, when the department was run by Mark Morial, who's now the head of the National Urban League, the superintendent of police was an outsider from Washington, D.C., who came in and set strict rules for the way police respond. The FBI was even embedded in the department for a while. So it shows to me, when you have, I think, very strong leadership, maybe officers will think twice or three times before hatching a cover-up like this. You know, some of the officers later on stood up and said, you know, we did wrong, I'm sorry, but it took years to get to that point. Maybe if you had stronger leadership and, you know, a lack of tolerance for cover-ups, That may have happened much sooner, and maybe Lance Madison would not have been held in jail, would not have been imprisoned.
Now, is there any sense that the New Orleans Police Department have learned a lesson from this incident?
I think it's an ongoing issue, to be honest with you. Even after the shooting on the bridge and after other tragedies during Katrina, the Department of Justice issued a report, a civil rights report, on New Orleans officers, and their findings were eye-opening. They found that during a 17-month stretch, I think it was in 2009, 2010, every time a New Orleans officer fired his or her weapon, the subject that they were firing at was black. And they found that the arrest ratio for teens was far disproportionate for the city. The racial arrest levels were far disproportionate. And the DOJ issued a consent decree with the department pushing for sweeping changes. You know, I think there have been stops and starts. You know, there have been some signs of progress, but not complete. There was, at that point, the superintendent is a former officer who used to work with Mark Morial, and used to work with that superintendent who didn't accept scuff laws. And he was pushing for change, but then, as I was researching this book, he resigned suddenly one day, and there was a new officer was brought in, or I should say an interim officer was brought in to help run the force. And so the department is still working on the consent decree. You know, they've said they want to do some things. They said they wanted to have body cameras, but when overseers looked into how often they use those body cameras, they found not always. So I think it's still very, very much a work in progress, you know, in a really a wonderful but tough urban city that has one of the top murder rates in the country. So these issues are still very much playing out. I don't think you can say the book is closed. Even though there is a consent decree, you can't say the book is closed on reform.
Now, you did talk to a lot of officers in the wake of this incident. What is their sense on how their department has acted since then?
I think that also can be mixed. I had talked to a former officer who spent 17 years in the department, patrolling the streets as a narcotics officer, a homicide, who now is a lawyer for police. So he really brings a really strong perspective. He thinks in some ways a consent decree can be a good thing. He thinks the intention on the department could force the department to have higher pay, for instance, at higher standards. He thinks it's a good thing. I think some others, you know, say that there's been a lot of money spent by federal supervision. They're not sure that's the best way to spend it. But I think overall there's a feeling that the outside attention can be a good thing, because the department, you know, knows outsiders are watching, and I think that can make a difference, especially when you have a time across the country where everyone seems to be watching these issues.
Now, what's the process at this point? Is a new trial in preparation for these police officers?
That seems to be the way things are heading, although that is not final, because the Department of Justice still has a possible avenue or two of appeal to try to change that ruling and to try to get the jury verdicts reinstated. So everyone's sort of waiting for the next step. But at this point, it looks like there may be another trial. That's where things stand.
Are those officers still in prison, or have they been released now?
No. The officers who fired their weapons are still in prison. They're still in federal prison. One of the officers convicted of that trial, one of the supervisors involved in the cover-up, he's been released on bond while the appeals are playing out. But the four shooters who were convicted and got sentences from 38 to 65 years, they are still in prison.
Hmm. The name of the book is Shots on the Bridge. In the wake of the 10th anniversary of Katrina, it's a really interesting read, given all the situation in our country when it regards police versus minority communities in this country, and it's a really interesting read. Ronnie Green, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate that.
Ronnie Green is an investigative reporter for the Associated Press and teaches writing at Johns Hopkins University, and he's the author of Shots on the Bridge, Police Violence and Cover-Up in the Wake of Katrina. It's published by Beacon Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.